When Melissa Gira Grant published Playing the Whore in 2014, it landed like a bombshell in feminist discourse. Neither a salacious exposé nor a victim narrative, the book challenged fundamental assumptions about sex work that had dominated public conversation for decades. Endorsed by luminaries like Barbara Ehrenreich and praised in The New Yorker as a persuasive manifesto, Grant's work quickly became required reading in gender studies programs worldwide. What makes this slim volume so powerful is its radical inversion of the typical gaze. Rather than examining sex workers as objects of curiosity or concern, Grant turns her analytical lens toward the systems and institutions that create and control the category of prostitute itself. Drawing from her background as both journalist and former sex worker, Grant articulates what many in the industry have long understood, that the greatest dangers sex workers face come not from their work itself, but from those who claim to protect, study, or save them. In Fargo, North Dakota, police create videos that look eerily like amateur pornography's opening scenes. Undercover officers arrange hotel meetings with suspected sex workers, negotiate services, and then signal for backup to crash in with guns drawn on partially undressed people. These videos aren't produced for entertainment. They're published as law enforcement evidence, exemplifying how we manufacture prostitutes where before there were only women. This pattern of police misconduct towards sex workers isn't isolated to small American cities. In New York, street-based workers report daily harassment and being denied assistance when victimized. Internationally, we've seen Greece's forced HIV testing of sex workers and China's shame parades where arrested women are marched through streets. This violence persists because society permits violence against some women to protect the perceived social value of others. The policing extends beyond those actually engaged in sex work. Transgender women can't walk freely without being profiled as sex workers. "I was just buying tacos," reported one Latina woman arrested after police found condoms in her bra. Sex workers are presumed to be perpetually committing crimes, with transgender women, women of color, and queer youth disproportionately targeted. This control-focused approach has even infiltrated certain feminist spaces through what critics call carceral feminism. Organizations like NOW support arresting clients while continuing to criminalize women themselves. District Attorney Kathleen Rice exemplifies this contradiction, celebrating male arrests while quietly continuing to arrest women under the guise of getting them services. This approach fundamentally treats sex workers as sexual objects, requiring control rather than workers deserving rights, creating conditions of perpetual surveillance and predetermined relationships. The transition from prostitute to sex worker represents more than a semantic change. It marks a crucial shift from viewing commercial sex as a state of being to recognizing it as a form of labor. This distinction, created by the people who perform this work, fundamentally challenges centuries of control. The word prostitute only entered English in the 16th century as a verb, while whore dates back to the 12th century BCE. Neither ancient Babylon nor Pompeii had prostitutes as we understand them today. This identity was constructed in the 19th century, transforming occasional behaviors into fixed identities that could be controlled by law. This paralleled the invention of the homosexual, creating criminal classes rather than just criminalizing practices. In 1978, Carol Lee coined sex work after attending a feminist conference where she challenged the dehumanizing phrase sex use industry. Many feminists still refuse to acknowledge sex workers' agency, with even sympathetic figures like Kate Millett believing prostitutes needed feminist rehabilitation rather than recognizing their capacity for self-organization. Sex work politics cannot be separated from the historical figures of prostitutes and whores. Though persistently framed as a women's issue, men in the sex trade are rarely considered part of the same occupation. Transgender women are presented only in stereotypes, while gender non-conforming workers remain nearly invisible, despite the industry's long history as reliable income for those facing employment discrimination. The shift to sex worker terminology is most complete in AIDS activism, where sex workers pushed back against being labeled vectors of disease. Sex workers' self-representation is most visible in their marketing materials, though these shouldn't be mistaken for complete representations of their lives off the clock. Anti-prostitution reformers misinterpret sex workers' marketing as evidence of labor conditions, failing to understand it as intentionally glamorized. They blame media like Pretty Woman for making sex work attractive rather than economic factors like the labor market and debt. This keeps their fight within the realm of representation rather than addressing real conditions. Despite progress in recognition, sex workers are still demanded to share their stories in ways that serve others' profits and curiosities rather than themselves. As Anne McClintock observed, the more prostitutes are obliged to speak of their actions in public, the more they incriminate themselves. Sex workers remain caught between demands to both convey guilt and prove innocence, still understood as legitimate targets for law enforcement and charitable concerns. Sex workers are stretched thin between literal and metaphoric representations, forced to navigate impossible contradictions in how society views them. The sharing of information among sex workers, essential for safety and negotiating work, is itself criminalized, with giving advice on how to do sex work considered a more serious offense than the act itself. This creates a dangerous information vacuum where necessary knowledge can't be safely transmitted. When the author received an email asking how to become a prostitute, it triggered panic, not from moral qualms, but because sharing such information could be construed as a more serious crime than selling sex itself. For sex workers, sharing honest information means taking social, political, and emotional risks. The necessary discretion warps under legal pressure, creating double lives, not from deception, but from managing legal risks and social exclusion. The case of Deborah Jean Palfrey, the DC Madam, illustrates how media exploits sex workers' stories. When her escort agency was shut down and finances seized, her client list became her only marketable asset, leading to media bidding wars and exploitative coverage that promised true tales of prostitution. Legal fictions, like requiring workers to sign contracts stating they won't have sex with customers, create dangerous conditions by preventing honest communication about health and safety. In many cities, even carrying condoms can be used as evidence of prostitution, forcing sex workers to choose between legal safety and physical health. These risks, not poor self-regard, are why sex workers might not share their experiences, even with each other. Sex work storytelling often becomes a form of striptease itself, where audiences disguise their voyeurism as compassion. The author refuses to conform her story to narrow roles, virgin, victim, wretch, or whore, that she did not originate, maintaining selective silence as resistance until more favorable legal and economic conditions emerge. The sex work debate functions as spectacle rather than substance, attracting audiences with crisis narratives while promising moral righteousness through vicarious suffering. These debates rarely center sex workers' actual concerns, instead focusing on questions like whether prostitution is violence against women or whether sex workers are exploited versus empowered, false binaries that serve the debaters more than those being discussed. Meanwhile, the questions sex workers themselves want to raise about definitions, self-description, factors leading women to oppose prostitution, and ensuring sex workers lead discussions about their own lives are sidelined. The author argues we should refuse to debate sex workers' humanity entirely, as such debates primarily build value for the awareness raisers, not for those who are the subjects of the awareness. The narrative around prostitution has shifted from fears about unruly sex workers to fears about the demand for commercial sex. Anti-prostitution activists frame male desire as a problem to be solved, positioning sex trafficking as driven by men's insatiable desire rather than by sex workers' own demands for housing, healthcare, education, and better lives. This framing creates a convenient problem that ignores deeper issues of poverty and inequality, Meanwhile, technology, once the telephone, now the internet, is cast as the vehicle for unchecked male desire, recycling old panics about new media's corrupting influence. Commercial sex adapts to its social and economic surroundings, from mining town saloons to business class hotels accessible only by keycard. These spaces, rather than stereotypical street corners, now host commercial sex, integrated into the service and leisure industries that cater to business travelers in bland, lonely accommodations. There is no singular sex industry, but rather a diverse range of labor forms, each with varying degrees of formality and legality. Collapsing all commercial sex into one category only reinforces the misconception that all sex work stems from violence, deviance, or desperation. Despite being part of the informal economy, sex work has organizational structures and conventions kept intentionally private. Yet scholars mapping informal economies often overlook sex work due to its criminalization, service nature, and female gendering. As commercial sex has partially decriminalized and workplaces have formalized, we've begun dismantling systems of control that endangered sex workers. This transformation questions why these punitive legal frameworks exist at all, since they were designed merely to make commercial sex unpleasant enough to deter involvement. Sex workers have adapted to gentrification by developing internet-based businesses and creating independent social networks, making their work more private. Sociologists describe this as convergence, the blending of the sex industry with leisure and pleasure industries. This involves both the normalization of purchasing intimate services, like childcare or personal training, and the formalization of sexually oriented businesses through corporate consolidation and online platforms. This isn't a moral crisis, as reformers claim, but an economic shift. The margins are changing as the industry becomes more routinized and resembles other service economies. Commercial sex workplaces vary widely, from suburban dungeons, actually just houses where BDSM services are provided, to college town escort agencies, transgender performers who use niche websites to book clients, and home-based porn producers. These aren't marginal spaces of transgression, but organized workplaces with systems, schedules, and conventions. A commercial dungeon operates much like any service business, with receptionists, shift meetings, schedules, commission splits based on seniority, and even employment references. Escort services might be as simple as one person managing a shared phone line and newspaper ad. Porn production can be run from someone's apartment, with their personal computer doubling as work equipment. Many sex workers draw income from multiple forms of sex work, not just to maximize earnings, but to negotiate varying degrees of exposure and surveillance. Each venue has its own conventions, skills, and challenges, though politically, there's usefulness in grouping these diverse practices under sex work while acknowledging their differences. The stereotypical image of street-based sex work, typically a woman of color in a short skirt approaching cars, is a lazily constructed composite that becomes a stand-in for all sex workers. This reduces their diverse work and lives to interchangeable symbols of urban decay or exploitation, even when presented by supposed sympathizers. Even street-based sex work varies significantly across different areas of the same city. Some exchanges are more accurately described as trade or barter within communities rather than work. The Young Women's Empowerment Project uses sex trades and street economies to recognize that trading sex for survival isn't always understood as work by those involved. The sex industry remains varied and porous throughout, from Nevada's legal brothels to urban street corners. Research shows one-third of Nevada brothel workers had never done other sex work before, coming directly from non-sexual service jobs. Three-quarters move between straight work and sex work, showing how selling sex is often just one form of labor among many in workers' lives. When sex workers claim their work is service work, it's not just to elevate status, but to acknowledge the reality that the same people often perform both sexual and non-sexual service labor. Susan Dewey's study of Rust Belt strippers found nearly all had worked outside the sex industry, often returning to dancing after trying low-wage service jobs because they preferred the possibility of periodic windfalls. For many, it was work outside the sex industry that proved exploitative, exclusionary, and without hope. Anti-sex work activists mischaracterize sex workers' position, claiming they insist it's a job like any other. The irony is that these opponents, with their more elevated positions in research and social projects, benefit from rescuing sex workers. As Emma Goldman noted in 1910, prostitution panics create fat political jobs for those who police sex workers. Even when sex workers create successful advocacy projects, as Selma James documented in 1980s London, feminist lawyers and women from the anti-porn lobby often take over, transforming women's struggle into jobs for the girls. Sex workers are known through surveillance rather than consent. Using Jane Fonda's Oscar-winning role in Clute as an example, where we first hear the protagonist through secretly recorded tapes, Grant shows how sex workers are typically presented through voyeuristic frameworks controlled by outside observers, whether novelists, reporters, or researchers. This surveillance combines voyeurism with monitoring by law enforcement and social services, always positioning sex workers as objects of study rather than subjects with agency. The sex worker is imagined as invisible and voiceless even when supposedly visible. From old phone book ads with clip art and suggestive text to modern online advertisements, sex workers carefully control their visibility while trying to earn a living. Many use stock photos or partial body images to preserve privacy. Online advertising creates a paradox. It gives sex workers more control over their work by providing direct access to clients, but simultaneously makes them vulnerable to surveillance. Police use these ads to build databases of workers' details and set up stings. Despite these risks, the benefits of online advertising still outweigh the dangers for most sex workers. Anti-sex work campaigners have targeted advertising platforms like Craigslist and Backpage, claiming these sites enable selling people. This rhetoric deliberately confuses advertising services with trafficking humans. When the Village Voice required face photos in adult ads, they shifted legal risks back to sex workers under the pretense of moral concern. Court challenges to these restrictions have had mixed results, with some judges recognizing the overreach of broadly written laws targeting online sex work advertisements. The concept of a red light district offers more than just sexual commerce. It creates spaces where class boundaries blur through human contact. These districts aren't solely sex businesses, but mixed-use neighborhoods where sex workers are integrated into community life. In San Francisco's North Beach, strip clubs and porn shops coexist with bookstores, cafes, restaurants, and corner stores, allowing sex workers normal neighborhood interactions and anonymity within visibility. Craigslist's erotic services section functioned similarly to physical red light districts by placing sex work advertisements alongside all other services, making sex workers virtual neighbors rather than segregating them. This integration was perhaps more threatening than the sexual content itself. All sexual commerce involves technology, from ancient Greek prostitutes who stamped "Follow Me" on their sandals to modern webcam performers. The term red light district itself reportedly originated with railroad workers leaving red signal lights outside doors of women they hired between shifts. Today's online red light districts are increasingly surveilled by police, politicians, researchers, and reporters who mistakenly assume increased visibility means increased activity. Sex worker feminists first theorized that all women live under conditions of whore stigma, a concept that reveals why no universal female class exists. As Gail Feddersen explains, this stigma attaches to illegitimate femaleness, not femaleness alone. Sex workers and others face this stigma for violating what Jill Nagel calls compulsory virtue, the mandate not just to be virtuous, but to appear virtuous. Sex worker feminism recognizes that while only some women are sex workers, all women negotiate whore stigma. This understanding has inspired solidarity actions like the 1982 London church occupation by the English Collective of Prostitutes, where both sex workers and respectable women's groups wore masks to protect identities while challenging stigma together. The concept of whore stigma has been diluted in its popularization as slut-shaming. This shift loses focus on those most harmed by such discrimination. Some feminist responses to slut-shaming problematically maintain distance, she's not a slut, rather than challenging the hierarchy that divides women into pure and impure. While slut might seem to broaden the tent of those affected, it makes actual sex workers invisible and fails to address the racial and class hierarchies reinforced by these divisions. As the author notes, if woman is other, whore is the other's other. Slutwalk protests emerged from a police officer's comment that women should avoid dressing like sluts in order not to be victimized. But critics, particularly women of color and sex workers, pointed out that slutwalk centered white women's indignation. As Brittany Cooper of Crunk Feminist Collective noted, black women's sexuality has always been understood from without to be deviant, hyper, and excessive. For many marginalized women, the boundary slutwalk protesters fought to protect was one they were never presumed to have. When the public expects stories of suffering from sex workers, those who speak out often feel pressured to present counter-narratives that distance themselves from stereotypes. They must either emphasize empowerment or survival, always proving they're not like those other girls. This creates a virgin whore hierarchy within sex work itself, undermining solidarity. The author examines how sex workers' truths become weaponized, noting that even Zaviera Hollinger's happy hooker wasn't actually depicted as uniformly happy in her memoir. She cites the case of Melissa Petro, a teacher fired after the New York Post exposed her past as an escort, despite her never discussing this with students. Anti-sex work women's groups remained silent about her unjust firing because Petro had criticized their campaign against Craigslist's erotic services section. The author challenges research that purports to show how self-objectification harms women, noting that such studies ignore the actual experiences of sex workers who routinely perform complex mental tasks while scantily clad. She traces contemporary fears about sexualization and pornography back to earlier anti-porn movements like Women Against Pornography, WAP, in the 1970s-80s, describing how WAP meetings featured emotional testimonials about porn-related trauma that created a communal experience of outrage and catharsis, not unlike the communal viewing of pornography itself. Drawing on film theorist Linda Williams, the author notes the similarity between the shaking of the body, whether consumed by sobs or ejaculations, in both anti-porn gatherings and porn consumption. She argues that anti-prostitution campaigns ironically reproduce the very sexualized imagery they condemn, citing examples like Denmark's Fresh Meat campaign that depicted nude women packaged like supermarket meat to protest sex trafficking. These campaigns, while claiming to protect women, exploit the same visual tropes they criticize. The author challenges the notion that sexualization is inherently harmful, suggesting it may be value-neutral rather than dehumanizing or empowering. She distinguishes between sexual objectification and actual violence, arguing that anti-prostitution advocates ignore sex workers' real concerns by positioning them as objects without agency who stand in opposition to all women. This framing conveniently allows these advocates to ignore sex workers' voices while claiming to restore their personhood. Sex workers, she contends, are already fluent in navigating objectification as women who move through the world. The true objectification comes from supporters who represent sex workers only as degraded victims and titillating object lessons, rendering their whole selves invisible while dismissing their capacity for social relations beyond their sexual labor. The author critiques Western saviors like Nicholas Kristof, who position themselves as experts on sex work while perpetuating harmful narratives. She describes how Kristof, protected by his New York Times credentials, participated in brothel raids in Cambodia, live-tweeting about scared, underage rape victims without their consent, continuing a tradition dating back to William T. Stead's sensationalist white slave trade exposés of the previous century. This savior mentality reduces sex workers to helpless victims, ignoring their diverse experiences and agency. The author contrasts her own visit to Cambodian sex workers, invited by activists without cameras or police, with the exploitative approach of Western media and NGOs. The author reveals how U.S. policies demanding Cambodia eradicate prostitution led to violent crackdowns where sex workers were illegally detained in horrific conditions, beaten, sexually assaulted by guards, denied HIV medication, and sometimes beaten to death. Human rights organizations documented women locked in cages and using plastic food bags as toilets. These rehabilitation efforts were praised by the U.S. State Department despite their brutal nature. A USAID-commissioned study found 88% of Cambodian sex workers weren't forced into the work, yet American policy treated all sex work as trafficking. When Cambodia demonstrated commitment to American values through detention and violence, the State Department upgraded their compliance ranking, revealing they see no meaningful difference between the elimination of sex work and the elimination of sex workers themselves. Contrary to savior narratives claiming sex workers need rescue and sewing machine training, many Cambodian sex workers previously worked in garment factories, but left for higher-paying sex work. Under the Women's Network for Unity, WNU, and Asia-Pacific Network of Sex Workers, APNSW, they organized protests against the crackdowns and illegal detentions in 2008. Sex workers documented abuses through cell phone photos, created videos sharing their experiences, and held rallies featuring testimony about detention and assault. Their slogan, "Don't talk to me about sewing machines, talk to me about workers' rights," directly challenged rescue narratives. APNSW received international recognition for exposing U.S.-driven abuses, though American policy remained unchanged. "When prostitutes win, all women win," declared Black Women for Wages for Housework in 1977, establishing the connection between sex worker rights and broader feminist struggles. The author describes Coyote Howls, the newsletter of America's first prostitutes' rights organization, which featured satellite organizations like the Prostitutes Union of Massachusetts, PUMA, and Professional Resource Organization for Women's Liberties, PROWL. A headline from 1977 highlights the convergence of sex workers and housewives around shared issues of violence, abortion, and welfare at the International Women's Year Conference. The author reflects on the historical alliance between sex workers and housewives as class allies, despite now being seen as rivals. Both groups are diminished by the same system that keeps women dependent on men, housewives maintaining legitimacy by not seeking wages, while hookers break convention by demanding them. Before founding Coyote in 1973, Margot St. James was involved with WHO, Whores, Housewives, and Others, with Others meaning lesbians. The National Organization for Women adopted decriminalization of prostitution as part of its platform that same year, showing early feminist support for sex worker rights. In June 1975, over 100 prostitutes occupied Saint-Nazaire Church in Lyon, France, inspiring similar occupations across the country. Though French feminist groups offered support, it was conditional. They viewed prostitution as something that should ultimately end, claiming solidarity by arguing all women are in the situation of prostitutes through forced marriage. The Lyon prostitutes recognized this support as outrageously conditional. The author acknowledges Sylvia Rivera's crucial role in the movement, who fought at Stonewall and later had to fight to speak at its anniversary when radical lesbians denounced transgender women as female impersonators. Rivera defended trans sex workers, explaining they didn't choose the work but needed it to survive in a society that wouldn't let them work as their authentic selves. With Marsha P. Johnson, Rivera founded STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, the first transgender organization in the U.S., which provided shelter and support for trans people who were harassed by police even when not doing sex work. The movement's creative activism included using a fashion show of streetwalker chic to protest U.S. policies restricting foreign aid to groups opposing prostitution. Sex worker activists were also lending their expertise in street medicine, harm reduction, and jail support to movements like Occupy Wall Street. Meanwhile, trans Latina women testified about police profiling them as sex workers regardless of whether they were working, using condoms in their purses as evidence. the movement was shifting focus from sexual liberation to addressing how sex becomes a vehicle to make people outlaws, particularly affecting those at intersections of gender, race, and class oppression. Whore functions as perhaps the original intersectional insult, targeting not just gender, but race and class. Building solidarity around this identity means recognizing that anti-prostitution laws don't just criminalize selling sex. They target entire classes of people as whores, whether they sell sex or not. This is why sex workers appear in multiple movements: queer and trans organizing, women of color activism, prison abolition, migrants' rights, and yes, feminist movements, despite some feminists' attempts to exclude them. What's needed isn't mere support for sex workers, but solidarity, directing energy at those with power to change sex workers' conditions. Endless conversations about how sex work makes non-sex workers feel accomplish nothing against vice police. Those who've never done sex work should question what their own communities and institutions are doing that harm sex workers, rather than fixating on sex workers' behaviors. Similarly suspect are non-sex workers' proposals for regulating the industry. Under criminalization, sex work is already regulated by cops. Common misguided proposals include taxing sex workers, who already pay taxes, mandatory STI testing, which drives people away from healthcare, and forced registration, which creates new underground markets. The first step must be creating space for sex workers to lead policy development, which can't happen while law enforcement targets them. The author concludes with a simple proposition. If sex work weren't criminal, sex workers could do so much more for themselves and each other. But we needn't wait for stigma to disappear. It's through our demands and imagination that change will come.